KSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Haukamalam and Squamish-speaking peoples. You can listen online at cjsf.ca or on our radio app, which you can download from the app or Google Play Store, depending on your device. And if you've got a request or want to call in, you can text us or call at 778-782-2573. And I'm Rebecca. I'm going to be your host for the next hour up until 11 a.m., where Democracy Now! Will then take over. I hope everyone's having a lovely start to their day, end, middle of their day, wherever it is you're tuning in from, and that you're having a good, I guess, start to your week. We're halfway through. I have got an episode today that I am really excited for. It is an interview that I very much enjoyed, I guess, taking part in, but also listening to. It is with one of my favorite professors from back home at my university. And as if you've been tuning into Intravenous for the past 2 weeks, you'll know I'm doing this mini series, which is exploring structural issues impacting survivor justice for rape and serious sexual offense cases. And for the past 2 weeks, I aired my discussion with Leonie, who is the CEO of a registered charity called Justice Is Now, back in the United Kingdom. And we were talking about rape and serious sexual offense cases, but really kind of focusing on her charity and what they do in their work with legal professionals and barristers. And it was a very interesting discussion. So I would thoroughly recommend you all check it out. It is on the Intravenous playlist on the website cjsf.ca. And yeah, I'm going to be airing part one today of my discussion with my professor back at Loughborough University called Dr. Dominic Wilmot. He is an associate professor in legal and criminal psychology there. And we had a really interesting discussion regarding the research that he does, which really focuses in on jury decision making and rape myths. So here's where I'm going to put the trigger warning that I'm putting in front of all of these episodes for this mini series, because there is a lot of talk of rape and sexual assault cases, rape myths. There's details of some cases put in there as well. Also in this part one, there is a bit of a crude analogy illustrating the multifaceted process that is consent. I've left that in, and I've spoken with the programming coordinator here, and we think that it is appropriate to leave it in the context that it is given, but I will say there is some crude language involved. So if you do not want to listen to any of this, or this topic will be distressing to you, I would recommend tuning out and tuning back in at 11 a.m. for Democracy Now! You can always load up another Intravenous episode that has aired before if you want to get your weekly dose of women and gender radio. There is a lot to choose from that is less heavy topics than this one. So yeah, and also the last part of my mini-series will be airing in 2 weeks, which is a panel discussion with Chloe, Jacqueline, and Patty, who are from different organizations but have come together to collaborate on a research project that is looking into the accessibility crisis of sexual assault evidence collection kits. So that will also be airing as the final conclusion to my little mini series, and it was a very interesting discussion. So remember to tune back in for that in a couple weeks' time. But before we get into it, I'm just going to give a kind of summary of the topics that are going to be discussed in this part of my discussion with Dom. there is a part two to it that will be airing next week. But for this part, we spoke a bit about him, why he chose to work in this area. We looked at conviction to acquittal rates with different types of rape, the Crown Prosecution Service and the police's role when you look into the statistics around rape cases. We looked at the definitions and examples of rape myths and a subcategorization of rape myths. We looked at how survivors are believing and internalizing rape myths and that it's not just impacting jury decision making. We also addressed legal professionals utilizing rape myths, why rape cases are more complex when it comes to the justice system, when looking at your trials and your evidence and how it differs. We touched upon the role that gender's playing as well, in which rape myths are invoked, but also the gender when you look at conviction rates linked to the gender of the complainant and things like that. We also pulled apart the impact that the justice process has on a complainant. We looked at the trauma, the invasive nature of the criminal justice system, how it can be a deterrent to actually reporting, and kind of looking at an overall picture of the victim survivor's experience. We also were touching upon the multifaceted nature that is rape myths. We looked a bit about digital strip searches in rape and serious sexual offense police investigations, which is the acronym RASO. And lastly, we began to touch upon the deficit that's seen in Canadian research, which then is continued into part two. So like I said, there is a bit of a crude analogy. It's around 15 minutes into the interview, as just a bit of a warning that there is a, he also has a warning before he says it. So there is plenty of time if you want to just tune out. It's about 30 seconds to a minute long. If you want to tune out that 30 seconds to a minute, it's about 15 minutes into the interview. So yeah, before I play that, I am wanting to start with a song that I think is very appropriate for this topic. I have played it before on Intravenous, but I think when you really listen to the lyrics, it really highlights, especially particularly female survivors' experience, but also females' experiences just, I think, in day-to-day life that don't get, I guess, enough recognition or understanding. So I would recommend listening to the lyrics more than just enjoying the, I guess, beat of the song. But this song is called Pretty Distraction by the artist Sky Daddy, and it is a single. So yeah, here is Pretty Distraction, and I will catch you guys once it is done.
She's sweet, lonely, just his type. He pulls her in with a drink and a smile. Naive, baby, don't think twice if it comes with a price. Run for your life. They're always trying to take what's not theirs. Drives me insane, it's not fair. What a terrible life for a woman who just wants to be left alone. To cover up her shoulders, 'cause the boys couldn't focus. Maybe they should teach him to control his own actions, but that's not what happens. They're always trying to take what's not theirs. Drives me insane, it's not fair. What a terrible life for a woman who just wants to be left alone. He says, what a pretty distraction. She's just what I need. And I know she'll be mine by the end of the night if I make her as insecure as me. What a terrible life for a woman who just wants to be left alone. What a horrible world for all of the girls getting catcalled as they're walking home. With keys in her hand, you don't understand what she's had to do to get here. What a beautiful life for a woman who knows what she's worth and knows why she's here.
And welcome back to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we've just heard the song Pretty Distraction by the artist Sky Daddy, which was a single. And yeah, I'm going to hop right now into the interview with the professor from my university, Dr. Dominic Wilmot. I'm also just going to reiterate, in case you have just tuned in, that there is a trigger warning on this episode. We are going to be talking about the likes of rape and serious sexual offences. So if that is not something you want to listen to, please tune out, and you can tune back in at 11 a.m. for Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining me today. I am going to have a conversation with one of my professors from my university back home. If you would like to introduce yourself, explain a bit about your research.
Of course, yeah. Thanks for inviting me, and yeah, really excited to take part in this. So my name's Dr. Dom Wilmot. I'm a reader or associate professor in legal and criminological psychology based at Loughborough University in the UK. And I also have a role at SWPS University in Wrocław in Poland as well. I sit within the criminology department here at Loughborough Uni, and I sit in the psychology department in Poland at my Polish university. And yeah, I teach things around forensic psychology and applied criminal justice. And I do research across a couple of areas, but predominantly attitudes and behaviours, problematic behaviours related to gender-based violence. And specifically the role of rape myths in jury decision making. So looking at rape trials and kind of the different attrition stages where rape cases, rape allegations fall out of the criminal justice system based on predominantly myths and stereotypes that victims themselves have, that perpetrators have, that are linked to their offending behaviour, police and prosecutors that impact their charging and investigative decisions. And then the final kind of hurdle and safeguard, which is jurors, that, you know, despite very few cases getting there, it's important, I think, to look at jurors because they are the final safeguard. They're the final stage that often jurors, that complainants, sorry, are hoping will give them access to justice, and that very rarely actually happens.
Yeah. So this, to me, this is such a niche kind of focus. Why did you choose to dedicate your career to this area?
Yeah, that's a great question. In all honesty, I did my degree in psychology with criminology at University of Huddersfield in the UK, and then I did a master's in investigative psychology at that same university. That master's covered lots of different areas. I was interested in rioting, so I actually did my master's thesis on psychology of rioting and why people were kind of motivated to get involved, often people who didn't have a criminal history. And then we covered jury decision making, not necessarily in rape cases, across a broad range of cases. And I just found it fascinating that we trust this group of random people to make decisions in the most serious of criminal cases. And so decided to pursue a PhD on that topic. That's what I did. And then when starting out looking at kind of what direction do I want to take this PhD, I want to look at jurors, but what case type in particular? I spoke to police investigators from the UK, I spoke to prosecutors, and they all said, look, if you're looking at juries, you simply have to look at jury decision-making in rape cases, because we get, you know, they're the cases that we go to trial, we think they've got a strong case, and then the jury return a not guilty verdict, and we're all just shocked. So against that backdrop, I started to look into the statistics and what was going on in those cases, and very quickly saw that, yeah, compared, you know, if rape and murder are the two most serious cases, murder has a conviction rate in the UK fairly consistently around 85%, whereas rape cases, you're talking from the point of an allegation being made, bearing in mind we know most allegations are likely true and false allegations are extremely rare, conviction rates are, from those number of proportion of rape allegations made, around 1% to 3% year on year. So clearly there is something going on in jurors' decision making there, and that's where why I decided to focus specifically on that area.
Yeah, I find it very interesting every time I go and look at the statistics, how shocking it is of the conviction rate being so minute, and yet it's not seen really anywhere, I would say, in like mainstream news or anything, of like, where is it changing that we have a conviction rate so low for just rape and sexual assault cases? Because I'm assuming, I don't know this, maybe you do, but I'm assuming rape and sexual assault cases have the like biggest difference in conviction to acquittals.
Yeah, I mean, it's the picture is complex, in all honesty, and it depends, like, because we also get different types of rape allegations, right? So we get stranger rape cases, they have high rates of conviction because often DNA, and I know internationally the picture is more complex, but in a UK context at least, stranger rapes have a high rate of conviction because DNA links that individual, DNAs are often available, and, you know, complainants often do report stranger rapes pretty soon after they happen. And so if that person says, I don't know this individual, and DNA connects them, it's fairly strong evidence, physical evidence, driving the juror's decision making. So the attitudes and biases that they have are not often activated. They don't have a chance to come into play because it's not as ambiguous as the majority of cases. However, in a UK context, 90%, 85 to 90% of cases year on year are perpetrated by someone known to the complainant, and therefore whether the sexual act happened is not in dispute. It's just simply around whether it happened with consent, and so physical evidence and all that other stuff is therefore irrelevant. The other complexity is it depends at what point you look at the statistics. So judges, and I had this experience recently when talking and working with a judge from the northwest of England, who said rape conviction rates in my court are extremely high, above 60% conviction rate. And if, you know, we know, without straying into kind of dodgy territory here and making accusations against the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK has come under a lot of scrutiny for some changes of tactics in terms of progressing rape cases and how they make charging decisions. And anybody interested could do some Googling around that and find some interesting stuff. And so basically the cases that come to court are often those that were, especially nowadays, it's an archetypal victim. They've not made an allegation against somebody in the past. They weren't wearing a short skirt. They perhaps weren't as intoxicated. Maybe they report fairly quickly. They're not, you know, the run of the mill. Anything that's seen to in some way undermine the credibility or veracity of the complainant, what tends to happen is those cases never make it to trial. So the Crown Prosecution Service, and to a lesser extent the police, are making decisions about where they focus their prosecutor on investigative resources, such that the cases they send to trial have a greater likelihood of conviction. So the statistics in that sense, it depends who's talking through the stats and at what stage they're looking at. But yeah, that's why I always think it's important to look at the report to convict, because we know, as you know, best, it's difficult to calculate, but best efforts tell us that false allegations are extremely rare. They do happen, and when they happen, they're widely publicized, but they happen infrequently. The government's own estimates, as well as independent academic research, puts it somewhere between like 0.3% and around 11%. So that means around 90%, even working off that high number, around 90% of rape allegations year on year are likely genuine. Despite that, the number that go to trial and receive a conviction is extremely low. So clearly there are huge numbers of cases that are going through the justice process and, you know, falling out of the process, that those involved are not getting the opportunity to seek access to justice at trial, and the perpetrator being brought to justice. That's the major issue. And that, I think, is not in dispute. Some people will dispute that, but, you know, there's a fair degree of logic to those statistics that it's difficult to pick apart, unless you come from the starting point that some barristers do, some judges do, and lots of members of society do, that contests the rate of false allegations, and they believe that huge numbers of these rape allegations are false, and the data simply isn't there to support that.
Yeah, it's interesting you talking about the Crown Prosecution Service there, in that in some kind of way, not manipulating the system, but almost like trying to guide it into a way to improve the statistics to make the picture look better than what it is, based on essentially using rape myths in biasing their decision making there, exactly what's happening in jury decision making. And obviously rape myth bias is something that you have a very big focus on in your research. And for the listeners that do not know, could you give us a definition of rape myths with some examples?
Of course, yeah. I mean, there's different ways you can encapsulate and describe rape myths. Essentially, rape myths are beliefs and attitudes towards rape and sexual violence that are widely endorsed, widely believed, but factually incorrect. So it's not that they're not true in a small number of cases. It's the reason they become rape myths and they're considered to be rape mythology is that they're used as a catch-all belief or attitude to explain all rape allegations. So some examples. Women make high, I already mentioned one. Women make false allegations of rape at a high degree. Like often when we hear about allegations of rape, they're false. Women make allegations of rape routinely when they are caught cheating on their partner. And so rather than kind of admit that they've been unfaithful in a relationship, they simply say the man raped them. Women make rape allegations in order to get access to children and the partner lose access to the children for custody. Only gay men can be raped. Real rape occurs between strangers where the person pins you down, forces you to the ground, and you have to fight and scream. And, you know, immediately having been raped, you leave that situation, you report to the police. So another myth there, delayed reports are seen as suspicious, despite the fact that best estimates, best data tells us 5 in 6 victims will never report. So only 1 in 6 victims will report their experience to the authorities. And therefore, if you look at the average amount of time is never. But the notion that members of the public, and therefore by virtue jurors, often believe that, wrongly believe that if you're raped, you immediately walk into the police station and ask to be swapped. And that's simply not what happens. That's not the experience of most victim survivors. And so these things become rape myths when that's what we think happens, but it departs from the reality of what happens. So when we hear that allegation, if we're a juror in a criminal trial, we wrongly perceive that there's something suspicious. Why did it take this person 2 years to report? Because most women would walk straight to the police station and ask to be swapped. So, yeah, there are a few examples of rape myths, false allegations, sexuality myths, and the reasons why women are said to make rape allegations.
Yeah, I think a common one that is kind of thrown about a lot, and I think like I've heard this since I was a lot younger, about, oh, well, the clothing she was wearing, she was asking for it, or, oh, if she was drunk, then she might be like regretting the decision, but she decided to do it anyway, and things like that. So I think for a lot of people, it's like that you don't realize that there is a whole area called rape myths that these all come under. It's kind of just common phrases that are thrown about in day-to-day life. Because if I'm thinking back of like, I've heard this from like, right, like probably when I was in secondary school, and that just being a common phrase that was just thrown about for women, especially since I went to a same-sex all-girls school. So to have that constantly thrown about, and we were constantly in our uniform, constantly spoken about how short our skirts were and being careful of how short the skirts were because of male teachers or male pupils at other schools, that when you get on the bus and things like that. So it's associated not just only when it comes to the severity of like rape and sexual assault, but also just in like day-to-day going to school and how you look and things like that, even if nothing happens to that like severe nature from it. Now,
yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. If I can just interject to say, you provide a great example there, which is we can kind of subcategorize these into different myth categories. So there's myths that excuse the behavior of a sexual assault perpetrator. So they didn't mean to, sexual urges, you know, men can't control their sexuality when they're, you know, if a woman's wearing a short skirt and they ignite a man's sexuality, they literally can't control it. So myths that blame the woman, which is she was wearing a short skirt, she shouldn't have been walking late at night, she drank too much alcohol, she put herself in a vulnerable position. And then those that kind of undermine what the reality of rape is. So that's not a rape because. So, you know, and that they kind of, we often invoke, you might have heard this concept of a real rape stereotype, and that's a common one, in that real rape is a stranger who forces you to the ground and puts a knife to your throat whilst you resist. But actually, statistically, 90% of the time, a real rapist, the person who is likely to rape you, is a current or former partner, somebody you know for sure. So that's why we say acquaintance, right? So yeah, more than half of the time, it's probably a current or former partner that sexually assaults you. So when we believe the stereotype, the misconception that it's a stranger, you will often hear people say things like, I think he might be guilty of rape, but he's not a rapist. And that's because there's this rape schema, this rape cognition, that is what a real rapist looks like. So when we deviate from those misconceptions, when we hear about statistically the most probable likely allegation of rape, we deem it to be untrue because it doesn't match our preconceived, inaccurate beliefs around what a real rape is.
Mm, yeah, and I think as well, you can trace it all the way back to it's looking how you're socializing people and children. Because if I'm thinking of obviously of me being at school and this being something that I was told repeatedly by the female teachers at the school, there was comments made about like making sure your bra straps weren't visible because of the male teachers that were in the school and things like that. And as you're automatically being socialized to be putting almost the blame on yourself and being like, well, it's on me that I have to be careful of what I'm wearing and things like that.
That's really interesting that you say that, and I completely agree with you. And that's why we often, you know, one of the barriers to reporting sexual violence is complainants themselves, victims themselves, believing these rape myths. So why would victims not believe them? They're drawn from the same societies where these myths are prevalent. So women who have experienced sexual violence, and men, but women predominantly, will say things like, I didn't tell him explicitly no, I didn't fight back more, I shouldn't have gone to his house, I was dressed inappropriately. All these sorts of things that attribute the blame to themselves and excuse the blame of the perpetrator. And of course, the reality is only rapists are to blame for rape. Women, and the way, you know, oh, this is kind of crude, so forgive me for this analogy, but I think it's useful for your listeners perhaps. A woman could lie there with her legs wide open and say, come and get me. And the second she says no, then it's no. And so the notion that any prerequisite behavior is an invitation for sex, like when you say no, it means no. And therefore the onus lies on the perpetrator, and in this case, a rape offender, in making sure that they have yes. A lack of no does not mean yes.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting direction to go in, especially with, I think I mentioned to you about the trial that's happening in Canada at the moment. It's a junior hockey trial. It's a multi-perpetrator sexual assault case. I don't think it's rape. I think it's just sexual assault. But to me, when I was reading through the closing statement, because obviously there's five defense lawyers for each defendant, and to me, the running theme seems to be this misunderstanding or miscommunication around consent and what the complainant consented to and what she didn't consent to, as well as on top of it, alcohol was involved, and that was a big emphasis. But reading the closing statements of the defense lawyers, because this is a topic I want to talk about with you in more depth, is the use of barristers using the rape myths and just dropping in little sentences. Because in the closing statements of the news coverage that was happening and summing up what they said, pretty much every defense lawyer utilized a different rape myth in their closing statements of like, oh, but she was drunk, she had consensual sex with one of them at this time in the bathroom. There's inconsistencies in her story because of alcohol, and also because it happened back in, I think it was like 2018, and obviously the trial's happening now. So it was, to me, a really interesting case. Obviously it's very current because they've just finished it and the decision is happening July 24th. And they've also, what makes this case again so interesting to me, they dismissed the jury twice and it's now judge-only verdict. So it's an interesting thing that way, because not only did you see in the closing statement the defense lawyers putting in little sentences for rape myths, they also are the reason both times, because the jury was dismissed twice, the defense lawyers were the reason for both times. The first one was one of the defense lawyers was speaking very loudly about the case in a public place, and I think jurors were overhearing, so a juror sent a note to the judge, dismissed the jury. And the second time, jurors said that two defense lawyers were laughing and mocking the jury. So they sent another note to the judge and dismissed it a second time, which to me, very strategic on a defense lawyer's part, because for it to be twice is a bit too much of a coincidence on it. But it's a very, to me, it's a very interesting case, because I think it's just a prime example of trying.